Emotionally, I was broken. Physically, broken. Didn't know who I was because the government put that stumbling block in front of you. And it's just devastated. Sorry.
Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Patrick Vernon, OBE. On today's show, we will be speaking to Wendy Williams, who is an Inspector of Constabulary and the author of the Windrush Lessons Learned Review.
My dad was here for over 40 years and faced down, you know, all the racism. We grew up with stories of Daddy and his friends talking about the race riots in Nottingham and being confronted by teddy boys. That was their first experience of a hostile environment. And now this is their second experience of a hostile environment. And we're not talking about all the experience and the discrimination that happened in between there.
You described the Home Office demonstrating institutional ignorance towards the issues of race and the history of the Windrush generation. Now, I've watched the response to the review online, and the community over the past couple of days have questioned why you use the word institutional ignorance rather than institutional racism. Is that something that you could elaborate on for us?
Can I say, first and foremost, I'm really pleased to be joining you and to have the opportunity to talk about the report. And I think everyone's questions will be answered by the report itself. And this was an evidence-based review. It was rigorous. It was really detailed. And I go into a lot of detail about the history of the Windrush generation, their circumstances, the experiences that they had, and also that sets the context for the reason that I say that there has been an unacceptable injustice that was done to the Windrush generation, because one can see that as a result of the contribution of the Windrush generation, that this really should not have happened. So in answer to your question, the report sets out clearly what it was that I was asked to do, what the parameters of the review were, and therefore why it was that I reached a conclusion that I did. And so to set that out, this was a lessons learned review. It wasn't a judge-led inquiry, so it wasn't set up like a court situation where people were legally represented and they would give evidence under court-like conditions. It was a much more informal process. And so as such, I wasn't able to look at the workings of the whole of the Home Office, which I would have had to do. Nor was I able to, you know, go into the sorts of legal texts that are required to reach the conclusion that Sir William McPherson reached. I set all of this out, but I make it clear that on the basis of what I was asked to do, and on the basis of the evidence that I considered, and on the basis that the information was that I received, I concluded that whilst I wasn't able to make a definitive finding of institutional racism, nonetheless, I identified elements of the McPherson definition which caused me significant concerns, and that's why I used the term that I did, which was I considered that the Home Office demonstrated institutional ignorance and thoughtlessness on issues of race, the history of the Windrush generation and their circumstances.
Young men like my dad, he didn't just pick himself up one day and say, oh, England sounds nice, I'm going to come. He had been invited here to come and contribute to the common wealth and build up the mother country.
One of the recommendations that you've made is that at the Home Office, they do tend to have, you know, a diverse workforce, you know, at junior level. But when it comes to senior management, you know, there is a serious lack of diversity. Is this something that you would hope would have prevented something like this Windrush scandal happening?
Yes, I've gone into the levels. I actually set in the report, and I'm sorry, Sinai, but I'm going to keep on plugging that report, because the report sets out what the levels of representation are. And given that at the more junior grades, the Home Office actually compares favourably. It has one of the more diverse, or one of the most diverse, government departments. I think its current representation levels of BAME staff stand at, I think it's 24%, but they are concentrated in the lower grades. So, in fact, in the two lowest grades, when you go further up the organisation, the figures look very different indeed. And we are talking about single figures. And that really isn't good enough, because my point is that if you've got a diverse workforce, it is more likely that the business that's done by the government department will be better informed about the different communities that the department serves. That isn't the case, and it wasn't the case in the Home Office, and it needs to be the case. And that's why I've made the recommendations that I have about workforce representation. And it's not just a case of bringing people in, you know, to satisfy some sort of quota. It's about understanding fundamentally what needs to be done to change the profile of the department at all levels, encouraging people to come forward, supporting them when they do come forward, and supporting them when they're in the role. Because it's also not enough just to be able to say, we've got X percent of minority ethnic staff at these levels. My question is, what are their experiences like? To what extent are they supported in their role? And to what extent are they able to give the best of themselves, or to what extent are they set up to fail? It's not enough to get them in the roles. There is a far greater responsibility that flows from that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of your recommendations, like you've just touched on, is that staff at the Home Office will need to learn about Britain's colonial history, the migration history, and also the history of Black Britain. In various training sessions. But one could argue, I mean, is it just enough to stop at, you know, training the Home Office, or is it something that everybody needs to learn and this history should be put on our national curriculum?
That was certainly the content of a couple of the responses to my call for evidence. And I do recall having discussions about the need to share the learning far more widely than the Home Office. What I had to look at was, what was I asked to do, and how might I be able to make the greatest possible impact? And because I was appointed by the Home Secretary to look into the Home Office, that's why I've made recommendations for the Home Office, and by that I mean both ministers and officials. Now, in answer to your question, there is a lack of knowledge across the board in terms of history and the legacy of the Windrush generation. So I would certainly support it actually being on the national curriculum, and you'd certainly get my support. But I looked at what were the root causes for this particular department, and what does this particular department need to do. I would hope that, and I've made this comment as well, I would hope that other government departments would look at the implications of the Windrush review and my report for their own business, because each of the government departments are given responsibility for serving their communities. And so what is relevant to the Home Office does have relevance to other departments.
Hi, Wendy. So I met you basically throughout the whole process. I remember meeting you soon after you got appointed, and I remember you had meeting with a number of migrant human rights organisations, and I've met you when you were taken to evidence with a number of organisations, and we've had conversations, and I've made a written submission to the inquiry process. How did it feel for you to be appointed in a very difficult time period? The public was angry against the way that the Women's Generation were treated. The Women's Generation, the wider community, was also angry with the government. And there you were, appointed to go through a process. How did that feel for you?
Actually, I was quite surprised. I was surprised to get the call. And I thought, goodness gracious, I took a deep breath and thought, wow, this is a huge responsibility. And I thought about it carefully because it was such a significant responsibility that what I decided was that if I was going to do it, there would be no half measures. You know, you either give this your all or you say, no, somebody else is going to have to step in. And so I thought long and hard, spoke to my family, spoke to my friends, spoke to everybody. And then I thought, actually, wouldn't this be fantastic, you know, to have the privilege of being able to carry out the review, especially considering my day job, because, you know, my day job involves me carrying out reviews, carrying out inspections, analysing evidence, getting to the nub of what the issue might be. So this was really potentially going to be something that I could really do a good job in terms of the ask. But it was such a huge challenge, that's why I paused. But I have to say, the reason why I agreed to do it was because I thought, what a privilege. You know, what a privilege to have this opportunity.
It's great. And I know that reading the report, and obviously it's very detailed, there's lots of real insight and analysis and the methodology you use. You want to explain to our listeners your approach, your methodology, because obviously that led to the 30 recommendations, which we still want to explore a bit more, but your approach on this.
Yes, I approached it in the way that I would other work that I do. So I wanted to understand what the problem was. So I approached it firstly by speaking to as many people who were affected as I could. I also issued a call for evidence. And in speaking to the people that I did, I spoke to, I think it was over 270 people. I went on a series of roadshows around the country. And what I was struck by was firstly, the dignity of the people who had been affected. It was really both a humbling and a harrowing experience. You know, to hear people tell you their stories about lives just shattered as a result of what had befallen them. So I heard about people who'd lost jobs, who'd lost their homes, who'd lost, you know, access to healthcare and other services, who'd been locked up, who'd been returned back to their country of birth, you know, and hearing about their experiences made me think this has got to be the focus of your review. So I want to make sure that the stories that I've heard are heard by everybody else, because it's only by hearing about how it affects individuals, you know, this is what happened to me, that I thought that the whole thing would resonate. And so, you know, I heard all sorts of stories, and
I remember, and I talk about this at the beginning of the report, I was in a meeting with, I think, about 8 people who had been badly affected. One of them was in his 50s, and he told me about his situation. He'd lost his job. He'd lost his home. He was living on his sister's floor. He had no idea as to how he was going to rebuild his life. And at the time, his status hadn't been certified. It hadn't been confirmed. And he said to me, I can't believe I've been treated like this by my beloved England. Well, to say that really affected me, I think, would be an understatement. So that was where I started. I started with the experiences, the real-life experiences that I heard. Then I started gathering the evidence. So I issued a call for evidence, and thank you very much, Patrick, for responding to that call for evidence, as did scores of other organisations, lots of other individuals as well. And that was really helpful to get their sense as to how and why the scandal had happened. But I was also given access to a Home Office team who actually did so much of the work, and I am really grateful to them for this. Because then we started getting the evidence from the Home Office itself. And one of the benefits of having a Home Office team carrying out much, if not most, of the review work was that they had access to the systems, so we didn't have all the difficulties in terms of security of access. But also, because of their experience, they were able to say, you know, we'd sit down together and they'd say, right, this is what we've gathered in respect of this. I can tell you from my experience, it would work in this, that and the other way. And so, you know, it really was an extensive endeavour. We looked at nearly 70,000 documents. I interviewed, I think it's about 800 people, including over 270 people who've been affected. As you say, Patrick, I carried out a number of engagement events. I think it was about 245 of them, with organisations, with people who'd been affected, with the representatives of people who'd been affected, with politicians past and present, with members of staff at the Home Office, from the most junior right through to the most senior. And so the one thing that I would say is you really need to read the report, because it is evidence-based, it is thorough, and the evidence is all there.
And certainly the evidence is definitely there. And even though your review was not on the same footing as McPherson in terms of the legal, the way it's established, the amount of evidence and the stuff that you did is probably on the same standard, actually, in many ways. So I think it's a tribute in terms of and a timescale, bear in mind, even though the report was delayed, and one of the questions I think people want to know the reasons for the delay and its unfortunate announcement in the height of the coronavirus.
Yes, and I mean, that's the thing. If I wasn't going to do it properly, I wasn't going to do it at all. And if I knew then, when I was first appointed, what I know now, I would have said the timescale that has been set is wholly unrealistic. Because you can't. I mean, you just can't consider nearly 70,000 documents and speak to nearly 900 people and, you know, do all of the analysis, the research, the sifting, the triangulation, you know, the consideration, and then bringing it all together and distilling it down into the essence of what you want to produce. You can't do that, especially given the nature and complexity of this scandal. You couldn't have done that in a matter of months. And there is also the fact that it was actually a year ago the Home Secretary then asked me to extend my terms of reference to look at a particular aspect, which was the right to rent policy, which is one of the hostile environment policies. So I was asked specifically to look into it, and there's a whole section of the report, I believe it's Annex G, that goes into the right to rent policy, and that in itself was quite an undertaking. So I would have liked to have completed it sooner, but because I know people were wanting to have answers, but I had to do this properly, and I'm satisfied that I did.
So I went on holiday with Samantha, my daughter. Then on the way back now, I was on the phone to you. And I'm saying, I'm coming back now.
Excited.
Coming back. And tried to get through. The man said no. And I'm saying, shouting to Samantha, just hang on a minute. I'm coming in a minute. God. No way.
At one point, it was just me on my own. Sometimes my mum would call me and I'd see the call. I'd be honest. I'd seen the call sometimes. And I just used to think, she's left me. But when you look at it, it's not her fault. It's the government, it's the people.
The 1971 Immigration Act confirmed that the Windrush generation did have a right to abode in the UK, but they weren't actually given any documentation and no records were kept. Now, am I right to think that this was probably the beginning of what we now know as the Windrush scandal, or do you think it started very much more earlier than that?
Well, I make the point in the report that the scandal was a long time in the making. And the reason why I said that is that it actually does go back further. It goes right back to the immigration legislation in the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, the purpose of which was to restrict, I said, certain groups from living in the UK, and by certain groups, I mean people from the Caribbean. And so I do think that, and it has, but this isn't me saying anything that's controversial. In cases that were dealt with at the time, it was accepted that that was the intention of the legislation. Now, the reason why that becomes important is that as different countries got independent, there were different impacts on the status of individuals from the Caribbean. But the main point is that if you came to the UK from the Caribbean between 1948 and 1973, then you had, as you say, the right of abode. So you had the right to be here and to claim your British status. But the Windrush generation weren't given the documents. They were invited to apply to register their status, but they weren't given the documents, and there were no official records. And even when they were invited to apply to register, we came across, and it's in the report, we came across an internal Home Office circular that said, yes, there's this registration scheme. It was in 1987. And lots of people did register, by the way, in 1987, but many people didn't. And at the time, the circular to Home Office staff said, we're not expecting the registration scheme to result in, and this is the quote, to result in a flood of applications, because they were worried about the capacity of the Home Office to be able to deal with the response. And at the time, all of the narratives in response to questions, if I don't register now, is it going to affect my status at any time in the future or now? The answer was, no, it won't affect your status. So that's why I make the point that the Windrush scandal was a long time in the making, because as we came to see, it did actually make a difference, because they weren't given the documentation, they weren't told that they needed to have that documentation, the documentation wasn't provided to them, and then when the hostile environment policies started to bite, the Windrush group, who did not have documents, were caught in that hostile environment net.
I mean, it's just been such a long, long road of hurt and disbelief for many people. I've been looking at the review, and some of the case studies are horrifying to even think that this actually happened. Is there any sort of story that you've particularly been touched by, or is it a case of every single story has its own unique message and its own lasting impact on yourself?
I was affected by the number and the range of different stories that I heard, and the effect that it had on people's lives. And I'd be surprised if people weren't affected by that. And I think it was a case of, you know, every single story that I heard had its own uniqueness, which caused me concerns. So there were so many, and that's why I made that the focus of the review and the focus of the report. I wanted those stories to be heard. One story that isn't in the report, but that also particularly struck me, was that we forget that members of the Windrush generation didn't only come to the UK to help rebuild post-war Britain. Some of them served in the armed forces during the Second World War and following that period. And in one of the roadshows, in fact, in a few of the roadshows, there were former servicemen who had served this country as they put it, served their country, and yet who found themselves caught up in this trap. And one of them in particular, he had served in the armed forces, and because he didn't have documents, when the hostile environment policies started to bite, he didn't have documents and couldn't get a passport. And he told his wife that he was afraid of flying so not to have to apply for a passport. And I just thought, imagine that. He'd served, and this was the experience that he had.
Just horrific and unbelievable stories we're hearing and we continue to hear. Before I pass you back over to Patrick, I mean, some of the recommendations you've put to right the wrongs is for ministers to admit that there was harm caused and to issue an apology to the Black, African and Caribbean community. I mean, how soon are you hopeful that we will get such an apology?
The Home Secretary apologised in the House of Commons when the report was published on Thursday, and Theresa May then apologised and reinforced how sorry she was. But as I said in the report, for the apology to be really genuinely received, more needs to be done. So this is about action. I'm delighted that my recommendation that an apology took place, you know, that's great, but it's what happens from now on. And that's why I've suggested a programme of meetings with the communities, exploring what their experiences were, so that they can have the sorts of experience that I had, and really understand how poignant and how pressing it is that we right the wrongs. So hearing from the community, recognising that something went wrong, engaging with different communities much more effectively in future so that the impact of policies is understood, but also changing the culture of the Home Office. Because I talked about this culture of ignorance and thoughtlessness, that really has to change. And I think that by understanding the impact of policies on all communities that could be affected, that greater understanding will help change the culture at the Home Office.
Every employee had a CRB check, and I never saying that I haven't got the precise paperwork. They just sacked me, and I was so sad. I went to the jobs in 2012 because we couldn't eat, we couldn't survive. If I didn't have my family backing me, behind me, I might have taken my own life.
Obviously, in terms of your report, it's quite clear that the disproportionality affected people of Caribbean heritage. Also, the other people affected by the scandal from Africa and other parts of the Commonwealth. Obviously, it seemed to be a large portion of Caribbean people affected. If another scenario here, Wendy, what if they were all Jewish? Would you then said that this was anti-Semitism, or if they were Muslim, would you would have said Islamophobia?
I would have gone about this in exactly the same way, which was to look at who was affected, how they were affected, and what the impact was in deciding whether or not there was anti-Semitism. What I would have had to have done was carried out various legal tests, including comparing what the approach was with people who weren't from the Jewish community. So how did the Home Office deal with their applications as compared to how did they deal with the applications from people from the Jewish community? So I would have gone about it in exactly the same way, and I would have been subject to the same limitations, but I would have followed wherever the evidence took me, and then I would have reported on what I had found.
Okay, because I think there's now a new case of another ism, and that's Afrophobia, because it's quite clear, and the work I've been doing around the whole Windrush scandal for the last few years, the disproportionate effect in black people, the way that people were discriminated and treated, which is further reinforced with the deportation flights targeting black people, raised the issue that, yes, there's an issue about racism, but there's actually about how it's targeted towards Caribbean people. And that's something, you know, obviously for future consideration. But reading all your recommendations, I know that you didn't say that the Home Office was introduced to racist, but reading 90% of the recommendations was about changing the culture, the policy, the procedures, and the mindset of the Home Office. And if this was applied to a local authority setting, which I've done work for, that I think the local government leaders would say, put the hand up and say, yeah, we recognise this is racism and we'll deal with it. But it just feels like when it comes to government, that they don't want to admit that, even though the McPherson definition has been there for 20 years, and actually the nuances of racism has moved on. Because, yes, a lot of the Home Office have a lot of beamy staff. I've met quite a few of them. I've been a civil servant myself, so I know what it's like. But the impact of the policy of the hostile environment and the Windrush scandal disproportionately affected black and BME people. So therefore, if you look at new definitions of institutionalised racism discrimination, 20 years on from McPherson, it's a different lens that we need to adapt because of, in particular, on intersectionality. A lot of people were affected by the scandal. A lot of women were affected by the scandal too.
In answer to your question, Patrick, one of the recommendations that I have made is for the hostile environment policy to be reviewed and fully evaluated to identify, firstly, whether it is discriminating against certain groups disproportionately. What my review showed was that the Windrush generation were badly treated and poorly served by the Home Office in relation to how they administered the hostile environment policy. I've called for the policy to be evaluated and reviewed so that there can be a comparison and an evaluation to see whether there is that disproportionality and whether that discrimination therefore is occurring. And I am very clear that that does need to happen. And that's why I've made the recommendation.
And that's great, because I hear rumours that the Equality and Human Rights Commission may take this up and do it as an informal investigation. If that's the case, That would be really fantastic, because I think we need to look at the whole hostile environment, definitely, to pursue that. As with all reports, Wendy, obviously you want to make sure that all your 30 recommendations are implemented by the government. And I've launched a petition in the last 3 days that all 30 recommendations should be implemented by the government, despite the virus situation that we're experiencing. But also, importantly, there should be some degree of independent oversight, because what's quite clear reading your report, and even my dealings with the Home Office over the last couple of years, they still have not learnt the lessons, even though they've been waiting for your report to arrive, but they could have done some stuff immediately to demonstrate that they were beginning to learn lessons. And the classic example is the Wondrous Compensation Scheme. £63,000 have been given 11 months out of 1,000 cases, and the way that they treat the people applying for that process for compensation, and if you speak to any of the victims, they say they've been treated by the Home Office almost like benefit scroungers. So the question is, can the Home Office be trusted to be implementing these recommendations, or does it require external oversight to make sure that those recommendations are implemented and justice is served for the Windrush generation?
We contacted UK Border Agency, Passport Office, the Foreign Secretary, which was Theresa May at the time. She then said, we don't have your passport records. You have to contact the High Commissioner of St Kitts Barbados. They said, no. All those documents are in the United Kingdom. They're in London. We went back to them. No, we don't have them. Contact St Kitts Embassy. And we were just going around
in circles. How are you going to put it right if the people in power can't help you and assist you to do that?
Well, I've been very clear in terms of what needs to be done. And it is for the department, it's for the Home Office, to identify how that's going to be done. One of the clear recommendations that I've made is that all 30 of my recommendations should be implemented. For the department to demonstrate that that's the case, I've asked them to put together a response and a plan that sets out what they're planning to do at different stages and at different times. I've said to be realistic with the current circumstances that would realistically take 6 months, because given the current circumstances, but also given my desire that the Home Office doesn't just go at this from a process point of view, but really stops and seriously considers, you know, seriously reflects on what does this say about us as an organisation? What does it say about us in terms of our culture and what really does need to change? So I've called for some considered response rather than a knee-jerk response. And what I've also done, whether they'll take me up on this offer or not is another question, but I have offered to go back in 18 months to assess progress made against my recommendation. Now, in the interim, as to how that is done, then that's for the Home Office to determine. But I would have thought that they would want to demonstrate that they are taking the recommendations seriously, but importantly, that they're taking action. And so anything that leads to that conclusion, leads to the public having confidence in the Home Office, I would have thought is something to be supported.
Well, you were appointed by the previous Home Secretary as part of righting the wrongs, and in definitely one of your recommendations, you acknowledged the whole concept of restorative justice in the sense of reconciliation. If we are to right the wrongs, what would that look like for you if we were to talk about this in about 12 months' time?
I would want to see a greater degree of understanding than I saw during the course of the review. I would want to see, and I mean this from top to bottom, whilst I did speak to some members of the Home Office who really did understand that this was a grave tragedy that had occurred and who were looking to try to understand how it could have occurred. On the other hand, I came across some members of the Home Office and also, because don't forget that I also interviewed politicians, I came across some politicians who really didn't seem to understand what had happened. And they thought that if anything, it was some, you know, bureaucratic error. And my point was, this was no bureaucratic error. This was, and I've called it this in the report, a profound institutional failure. So I would hope in a year's time that there wouldn't be this narrative that, you know, the scandal occurred as a result of an unfortunate set of events and it wasn't foreseeable, because my review makes it clear and it sets it out in all sorts of different ways. I've got flow charts, I've got diagrams, and I've also got the written evidence. This was both foreseeable and avoidable. And so I would hope that if I were to go back in a year's time and if I spoke to somebody who was really senior and somebody who was a middle-ranking official and somebody who was really junior, that they would be saying to me, this was a terrible tragedy. It was a terrible error. It shouldn't have happened, but this is what we're doing to try to put it right. That's how you change a culture, by changing the approach, by acknowledging that something's very serious went wrong, and by doing something about that.
I haven't been treated like a British citizen by the British government. They've left me basically to swim or sink. I've been a bit depressed, to be honest with you. I feel a stranger here now.
Well, all I can say, Wendy, thanks for your hard work, your diligence, and your degree of objectivity to go through a very difficult process, ones which still answer some questions. People still looking for justice around their rights. I mean, one of the things which I was hoping that could have happened was that that everyone should have automatic status of their citizenship. So just still going through the whole rigmarole process, going through the task force, because if your analysis is correct, that 1973 Act made a difference, and people should have been given that status confirmed automatically, and now people still have to demonstrate that. Even today, which obviously that probably requires more changes in the law or something for that to happen. But we recognise the work that you've done, and more importantly, the time that you've given to share this on the back of the report we launched in the last few days.
Not at all. Happy to do it. Thank you.
Wendy Williams, it's been fantastic speaking to you today on the Voices of Windrush. We thank you for your time and, like Patrick said, your diligence for looking into this scandal and for also putting forward your 30 recommendations, which we hope to see unfold in the coming years. Thank you.
And it's a very hard struggle. And I want them to right the wrong that they've done, not just to me, to other people that they've done.
Colourful.
Colourful radio.
The few lines from the summary of the Windrush Lessons Learned review by Wendy Williams. It says, members of the Windrush generation and their children have been poorly served by this country. They had every right to be here and should never have been caught in the immigration net.
Colourful radio.
The many stories of injustice and hardship are heartbreaking, with jobs lost, lives uprooted, untold damage done to so many individuals and families.
Colourful radio.
A range of warning signs from inside and outside of the Home Office were simply not heeded by officials and ministers. Even when stories of members of the Windrush generation being affected by immigration control started to emerge in the media from 2017 onwards, the department was slow to react.
Colourful radio.
The Home Office must acknowledge the wrong which has been done. It must open itself up to greater external scrutiny, and it must change its culture to recognise that migration and the wider Home Office policy is about people,
whether its objectives should be rooted in humanity.
Colourful,
Colourful Radio.
Okay, so, yes, it was really great to have Wendy on the show. I mean, I think she's probably, this is the first popular exclusive interview we've had with her, straight from the report coming out a few days ago. So, and actually it adds to all the shows that we've been doing over the last 7 months around Voice of Windrush. When we started this series of shows, we were first started off with looking at people applying for their status under the Windrush Task Force. Then we explored the issues around compensation. Then we heard stories of survivors, what they were going through. We explored issues around mental health. We explored stuff around national curriculum. We explored stuff around different ways of acknowledging the Windrush generation of history. And then obviously now we've got Wendy's report, which kind of, in many ways kind of brings it all together in many ways. But I think the big question is, I don't trust the Home Office to implement all these 30 recommendations. As I said to Wendy just a while ago, that they have only given that £63,000 in compensation in 11 months, and they've not learned anything at all. Their attitudes are the same, their behaviour is the same. They need to literally, that department needs to close down and start all over again. That's the only way you can deal with it.
I absolutely agree. Probably a lot of attitudes are intergenerational in the Home Office. A lot of, you know, ways and their ways of doing things and maybe handling people's immigration and people's situations is probably ingrained. It's not fit for purpose. The only way we would feel very comfortable with, you know, going to the Home Office if we had any issues to do with our status or anything like that is if we saw significant change. Now, just saying, oh, we did training on race relations, I don't feel like that would be enough. The community deserves a full-hearted apology. And also we deserve, you know, it's 2020 and we can't have these issues that are related to race, people's ethnic origins still continuing?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, my first report was interesting because it made a series of recommendations. Those recommendations, there was a Cabinet Office stroke number 10 committee that oversaw the implementation of the recommendations to the Met Police. I think we should be using the same principles for the Home Office. I don't trust Priti Patel looking at all those 30 recommendations and then choosing which one she thinks is convenient. People want action, and the only way you're going to get the action is there's external oversight, that we are watching over her to make sure that her department is implementing those recommendations. That's the only way it's going to be taken seriously. But also, Wendy's report was limited in its terms of reference. There are some big, big questions which she couldn't explore, because of the timescale and the remit of her investigation. So the three big questions is that it didn't explore the relationship between number 10 and the Home Office. Obviously, she focused on the Home Office, but I think the hostile environment and the issues of the Windrush scandal goes straight to number 10. So that involves the role, what was Ben Cameron doing at that time. I know she mentioned the speeches he made and stuff like that, but I think the paper trail needs to go straight to number 10. Secondly, it hasn't resolved the status situation of thousands of people who have not sought out their status even so. And that's why in my original petition I did 2 years ago, people should be given automatic status. This has to go for this rigmarole of demonstrating improvement of the British. That's still a big issue that is still outstanding. And even though Wendy didn't look at the compensation scheme, so it was left a separate process, it's quite clear that the Home Office can't manage the compensation scheme. So that has been managed by another government department, and people should be given automatic payments immediately because we're all struggling now with this coronavirus, you know.
Yeah.
How are people who lost their jobs and money and everything, they need money to survive now, even more so, and they're vulnerable.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how they expect our elders to be surviving if they're still waiting on compensation. Like you said, it's been 2 years for some people who applied and they've heard nothing, and only £62,000 paid out between, you know, 36 people. I mean, you do the math. That's equivalent to peanuts. That's not equivalent to 10 years of somebody, say, losing their wages, or somebody losing their home, or somebody being denied services and NHS healthcare. You know, it just doesn't add up. I feel like there needs to be a big overhaul. The compensation scheme needs to be looked at. It needs to be quicker. It needs to be more efficient. It needs to be fair. And definitely definitely the issue of status is something that needs to be looked at urgently, because I'm hearing stories of people being given NTL cards and they're still being denied. Yeah. So a long, long process. But, you know, glad to speak to Wendy through her lessons learned review.
Actually, and also we're approaching the second anniversary of a scandal in April, and it's important that the government starts implementing. I know she says it can take a while for it to be implemented, but there has to be some clear intent around by the second of anniversary in April, the Munro scandal, that this movement, there has to be some kind of movement going on. Otherwise, again, the justice has been delayed and denied to the Munro's generation and their children.
The onus is on us as the community, as the children and grandchildren of these people. We have to, you know, stand up and fight for them. Many of them can't anymore. They, you know, they're too weak, or many of them are no longer here. A lot of them have died before they've received compensation, before they've received an apology. So it's on us as the community to make noise for them and to demand justice, to make sure not only this doesn't happen again, but those who are suffering are in receiving of justice that not only that they deserve, but it's the right thing for them to get.
Colourful,
Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.
So on the day of the Lessons Learned review on Thursday, I launched a new petition on 38 Degrees platform website with the title Windrush Never Again, for the government, Boris Johnson and Priti Patel to implement the 30 recommendations with independent oversight. And since over the last few days, it's gone absolutely crazy. Just under 60,000 people have signed my petition in the last few days.
Wow.
If we can get 100,000 over the next few days, I would definitely want to go with some Windrushers and present this at number 10. Assuming that we're allowed to even go to central London because of the lockdown that we're all experiencing. But I think it's important that we let the government know that you've done this report and we want action.
Your petition is fantastic, because it's a case of we have to have the power now as a community. Get together, sign Patrick's petition and make sure that there is an independent advisor, independent body looking at the government to make sure that they implement these 30 recommendations by Wendy Williams. So everybody, please sign Patrick's petition. Patrick, where can they sign it?
It's on 38 Degrees, and it's called Windrush Never Again. Or just do a Google search, 38 Degrees, Windrush Never Again. The voice of the Windrush still continues.
Absolutely. Like Patrick said, you have been listening to The Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, Patrick Vernon, OBE, and we was joined on the line by Wendy Williams, who is the author of the Windrush Lessons Learned Review.